You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. And live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you
lie? 9 minutes after nine on the west coast of the United States. Joining me, Andy Milburn again. Andy, what's going on? How's your day so far?
Hey, Mac. Not too bad, actually. I think my wife and I will be quite relieved when the kids go back to school. It's been a good summer, but you probably didn't remember that feeling.
I never had that feeling. I love my kids, man. What do you mean? I don't want to see them back.
I wouldn't trade it for anything.
You went to boarding school. You're like Harry Potter. You don't have like our experience.
Don't think that that's not a constant threat in our household to send both our kids to boarding school. You know, I mean, I would never do that. I mean, you think about what a formative period of your life is between the ages of 8 and 18. I mean, that's when you pretty much shape everything. So to kind of outsource that, I think I hope no implicit criticism of my parents. They meant the best for me.
It's not implicit, okay? It is explicit what you're doing right now. So don't think you're soft peddling this. Your criticism of your parents. So whatever. I mean, it was the way they did it, right? You turned out all right.
Oh, yeah.
You survived
yeah.
all the hazing and all the different beatings you got for being a punk ass kid. So I mean, it is what it is. But I, if you don't threaten your kids, if you don't scare them, if that's not part of the way you parent, then I don't really think you're giving your kids the full experience that you should be giving them. And you're not raising good human beings. So I commend you for it. I commend you for it.
God bless you, Mac. What? Yeah, as far as being a punk ass kid, I think I'm like a 56 year old punk ass kid now.
There you go.
But I don't think anything would have worked.
So where's home these days?
I'm in I'm just outside Tampa, in a neighborhood called Fishhawk. Some of your listeners who've been in Tampa may have lived here. There's a pretty heady density of military guys here. This is where when I retired, I mean, the deal was because my wife left the army, really to kind of follow my career when we left Hawaii. So the deal, my promise to her, was that when I retired, we'd locate where she wanted to locate, where she had a job. So
Tampa.
She works, she's an occupational therapist. She works with, kids with learning disabilities in the local school system and does a superb job. So, I'm very happy to be here.
So are you working now? Are you just enjoying the fruits of your retirement and glomming off your wife's profession? What are you doing?
I'm working part time for the Joint Special Operations University, which is here in Tampa. But actually, you know, I'll put in a quick plug because they are hungry to get Marines on their adjunct faculty or former Marines. And so, what I do for them, I'm a contractor and I work overseas teaching the planning process, basically to special operations officers in various countries. So, you know, some of the garden spots of the world in April, I was in Niger, in May in the Ukraine, and then June, Tunisia, and I'm going back to Tunisia next week, and then Somalia next month.
Congratulations to that. Yeah. Make sure your shots are current. And just so everybody, just so everybody knows, the shots when you go to places like that, like they're not like one or two, okay? They're like you get a shot when you go to Somalia of some kind of hardened substance that they fire into your ass that it takes like a week to melt or something. I don't know what it is, but yeah, they're not like your normal, like, oh yeah, you want your tetanus booster or some bullshit like that? No, these are like real shots that if you don't have this, you're going to die because your immune system is not ready for the robust life that people live in Somalia.
That's right. Yeah, they're fairly debilitating shots. But you know, I love doing what I'm doing. It's 2 weeks work overseas. I love teaching because when you know, really that's what we did as officers, right? I mean, that was a huge part. For me, that was probably the most pleasurable part of being an officer was the teaching part, whether it was not necessarily in the classroom, but the fact that you were always trying to teach your subordinates something. And so now, being able to do that and just focus on that is terrific. And 2 weeks work, and then back at home for about 2 or 3 weeks driving the kids to school.
Well, so let me ask you this: so you go to Somalia? That's not exactly going to Disneyland. You know, what do you go there and do? I mean,
this is just an assessment.
Got it.
You know, prior to a future engagement, but it's, you know, looking at their nascent military, nascent special operations battalions, and then coming up with on the officers here. So, you know, you can imagine that's pretty fascinating. It isn't going to a place with a set POI and just teaching guys. It's going to find out first, hey, what do these guys know now, and what do they need to know in order to do what we hope that they will do. I'm loving retirement. I miss, just probably like you do, I miss aspects of the military. I miss being around Marines. There are other aspects I don't, you know.
What I do now, I mean, honestly, Andy, you can tell, I've got the best job in the world, honestly. I mean, and I didn't really design it to do that. I mean, I think as long as you pursue your passions, you'll find something, right, in that wide vein that you're passionate about. But I'm blessed in terms of, I interviewed General Mattis 2 weeks ago about discipline for about 70 minutes.
Yep.
Right? I mean,
yep,
I awesome. You know, yeah, General Van Riper, his interview about discipline. And, you know, and then I get to interview all kinds of Marines that have fought in every war we fought in that are still alive. And then I turned the post-traumatic winning thing, all I did was shared the lessons, like you talked about teaching. And for those who listen to the program, this is not a secret, but if you're just listening for the first time, I love to teach. I had some of the best years of my life were at the basic school in IOC, and that's where I crossed paths with Andy. But the chance to coach and teach and mentor and make these young studs better, more confident leaders as they walked out the door. To me, and that's what I loved about leading was what Andy talks about. So, and now I still get to do this. You know, I still get to go, you know, and speak to Marines on a regular basis. You know, I'm doing it this month, and now doors are opening to the other services because of Marine leaders that have taken these lessons from our culture, put them into practice. And, you know, 2nd Marine Division, 6 suicides in the 6 months preceding me doing post-traumatic winning. In the 8 months since... What the hell was that? That's a big dog, man. The,
It's a tiny dog.
It's not a tiny... Okay, that dog's got a ventriloquist. But in the 8 months since, they've had one. And so... It works, and anybody that will follow in the footsteps of the 2nd Marine Division will have the same success. And it starts with, you know, confronting the truth about what it is to live with the traumatic stuff that everybody in life really lives with, and not just the military, and then getting after the counseling piece of it. We can no longer afford not to counsel, like many people did when we came from a tougher culture. We were tougher people. That culture doesn't exist anymore. Our culture is soft. It doesn't have consequences. It doesn't have discipline. It doesn't deal with adversity. And so we've got to know them more. We've got to love them better. We've got to be more into their lives. And that's what they need, and that's why they come here. And we're not doing it. And that's why you see those suicide numbers. And I'm convinced that anybody who goes down that road that will emulate the 2nd Marine Division will have the same result. No doubt in my mind. And so I got a pretty cool job, man. You're not going to see me in Somalia anytime soon. Unless somebody says, hey, Mac, we want you to come over and do post-traumatic winning in Somalia. Then I'll be like, all right, man, I'll be there. But
well, you've made your luck, Mac. I mean, I'm not just sitting here and saying, I am a fervent fan of yours, but I'm not just sitting here blowing smoke at you. What you're doing is terrific, and knowing that, the good that you're doing, I think probably feeds back into your sense of accomplishment and satisfaction with life. So kudos to you. I couldn't agree with you more about what you just said about post-traumatic winning, and we've got. One thing I've realized over the years is we quite rightly focus on the effects of combat stress on junior Marines, right? But there's plenty of leaders out there too who have been suffering the effects, and it's taken a little bit longer to get those guys to come forward.
Well, and the other part that I have, that I've learned, and every time I do this, somebody introduces it. And the things that they stand up and say stun everybody in the room. And most of it, virtually none of it has anything to do with combat. General Furness talking about the day he found out his daughter was mentally retarded and how crushing that was. And his voice cracking in front of 1,000 Marines at every event that he stood up and did that at. And the look on their face is like, wait a minute, he's a general they don't have that shit in their lives, right? General Pasagian talk about being 15 years old on Thanksgiving Eve in, I think, Brooklyn or the Bronx or something like that, working at an ice cream store. Dudes came in at closing, put a gun in his mouth, right, after they got the shit beat out of him, right, and thought he was going to die. General Mullen talking about when he was a first lieutenant in Okinawa, his little brother, right, they had 4 or 5 boys together, and then one, the mascot, 10 years later, like many happen, and like many families would deal with, me included. His little brother drowned in Philadelphia after a heavy rain, playing with his friends near a creek, and he slipped and got sucked into a culvert. And then at MCRD, General Heritage talk about raising 5 foster children while on active duty, in addition to his own 2. And telling the story about one of them is in jail now, and everybody sits there and you just like, are you shitting me? And then
and then
Colonel Fahey talking about, dealing with suicide first as a regimental commander, second in his family, and then driving over the Coronado Bridge and seeing somebody on the hood of their car getting ready to jump, and he throws his car into park, and he tackles this woman on the hood of her car. He said, but all he could see was his family member. And so you're sitting there, and it's like, 83% of the Marines who killed themselves last year had never deployed. What's their problem? Well, we've got it. And so it's very encouraging because all the things that remedy this are resident in our culture. We've got to take a step back. We've got to look at it. We've got to recalibrate a little bit and then get after it. And if we do that, if you love them, if you care about them, if they know that they have somebody to talk to, they don't go down the road of, that leads to destructive behavior. Now, hey, I want to ask you, and I was going to ask you at the end, but I'll ask you now. You alluded to, your own struggles. And for those of you who don't know, Andy, infantry officer, a battalion commander, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, the Lava Dogs, Special Operations Regiment. The Marine Raider Regiment, if you will. And so you're no stranger to operations. You're no stranger to these events. You alluded to, you dealing with your shit. How's that going?
Much better now. And so, in deference to your listeners, I'll keep this as short as possible. But hopefully again, this is a, you know, this is a message that, that may help some people out there. And I couldn't agree with you more that the best way to have guys come forward is for leaders, you know, so to share some of their own vulnerabilities or tragedies. So, you know, very, very briefly, I came back, or as briefly as I can, I came back from my second deployment, and I was basically not right. In many ways, it was a difficult time in my life. Anyway, I just got married. It was a, you know, my year at SOAR. But I was compensating in unhealthy ways. I was probably drinking too much. I was, you know, snapping at people. Credit to a lot of my friends who, you know, stayed with me during that time. It didn't get better over the years. You know, I kind of tamped it down. And then I had a year that was a truly transformational year for better and for worse. That was, surprisingly enough, right at the end of my career. And I'm just going to cover it very quickly. But in some of your listeners may remember the beginning of late 2014 and the beginning of 2015 was a pretty hard time for a lot of us who fought in Iraq, because we were watching ISIS sweep across, you know, recapturing places that, that we pay for in blood. And that's no exaggeration. You know, Ramadi, Fallujah, in my case, Mosul. You know, it was the list of ISIS conquests was like a list of battle honors for the Marine Corps and indeed for the U.S. military over the previous 10 years. And it just really seemed as though it was all for nothing. And it almost happened beneath the radar. You know, it was almost not hitting U.S. mainstream media until, you know, around the spring of 2015. So that was a tough start to the year. And then I learned that I was going to lead the Special Operations Task Force and the counter-ISIS fight, as I mentioned yesterday. So that was kind of a boost, and we started to put that task force together. But in the midst of that, we lost seven of our guys, seven Marine Raiders, in a helicopter crash. You know, when you have a regiment and you have, you know, over 1,000 guys, the Marine Special Operations Regiment is quite small, but nevertheless, 1,000 guys, you don't know every single one member of the regiment. I did know these seven because I just happened to. I PT'd with them the night before they left for Florida. Following the helicopter crash, I went down to the site of the crash. I had to identify the bodies. And we were kind of racing against the media because CNN broke the news before we had a chance to inform the relatives. So we were in a terrible situation where they knew that their loved ones were missing, but they hadn't had verification yet that they were dead. So I identified them. And then over the course of the next weeks, months, actually, I visited every one of the families first to visit them, talk to them about what had happened, attend the funerals, memorial services. A lot of you guys have had to do this. I'm not pretending that this was unusual. And then when the investigation broke, I did that again. I had done that before. We have all done it before, but for some reason, and I can't explain why, this time it was different. And, you know, during the course of that time, I took a trip really into kind of the geographic and figurative heartland of America, you know, from a beautiful mansion in Connecticut to a trailer park in New Mexico. And the only thing that united these families was that they had a loved one in the Marine Corps. And if with every visit, because I got to know these families pretty well and it, you know, came back several times, with every visit, it seemed as though I was absorbing a little more grief, which again may seem a little self-indulgent to some people, but you know, but bear in mind, I'd seen, just like all of us, seen plenty of guys killed. I'd had to inform families before, but it was almost as though this was It was different. It was an accident, and I was confronted over and over again with the effect on the families. And I would challenge anyone to say that that doesn't affect them.
No, yeah. Look, anybody who says it doesn't affect them is lying. And that's just a fact, and that's what I think the significance of a post-traumatic winning is, that I'm not a behavioral person. And it's really interesting. When I first started doing this, the behavioral people were very leery of, me throwing their shit in the street. And they were spring-loaded. And, you know, the truth is they're trying as hard as they can. Post-traumatic winning comes from operational people. It comes from grunts, passing down an oral tradition of how we help each other. But before there was a diagnosis of PTSD, you know, people knew that it happened, and they helped each other, right? Steel sharpening steel. Yeah. And we don't talk about it like this in the mental health arena, but that's what I got told in 93, in September 93, when a helicopter crashed inside my assembly area. And your tribe's trying to save Marines, and they're dying. And it sucks. And it's an intimate shit experience. And my gunny said to me, you know you're never going to get over this. And I asked him, I cussed at him a lot. And then I asked him, where does that come from? And he said, it comes from Vietnam, guys. And it's been the best advice I've ever gotten in my life, because whenever this shit bothered me, I knew there was nothing wrong with me. But not everybody gets that advice. And you get people saying, well, I wish you could just get over it. I wish you could just be like you used to be. You know, and so you live with this stuff. And no, and look, if you don't acknowledge that that comes with a toll, then you're not taking the first step to live with it. Because what you said, Andy, you know, it's not self-indulgent for you to say this takes a toll on you, right? I mean, but in our culture, I never had a conversation about it, and that's why that's why I love doing it so much, because it's like, hey, look, we just have to stop faking it, man, because we're all faking it, because it's all.
You're absolutely right.
Right.
You know, we say, we accept it, but in the end, we don't want to be. We feel awkward about it, admitting it, if we have guys following us, because we think, hey, I wouldn't want to follow a guy, whose head wasn't in the right place. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, when I say that term, it's not something I believe in. It's just something.
No,
that
it's the way it
I
is,
think
though.
It's often the implicit thought among Marines.
Right. No, I'll follow a guy who's a drunk. But yeah. A guy who goes to mental health, you know, and this is not now, but in years gone by, it was acceptable to be a drunk, right? And we would, you know, we'll cover for you, we'll drag you home at night, we'll drive you home, we'll get your car to where it needs to be. That was okay, but to admit that you were dealing with it, and we simply didn't do it, and so you know, that's the cool part of. To me, of all of this, is, look, man, if you won't admit that you're dealing with it, whether it's your personal life or the things that we see on active duty, then you're lying. And the rest of us know it. So stop lying and help and be part of the solution. So.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more, Mac. And, you know, to just very quickly to continue the story, because it gets
worse.
You know, it gets worse, but there's a... I think, you know, you've got to kind of find a silver lining to it. So, we went back to, you know, obviously putting the suture sodif together. Two or three months later, my daughter was killed in a traffic accident. It was 2 months before we were due to deploy, and these things obviously are always, hard to talk about. And
how old was she?
She was 23. And she, God bless her, she was a better person than I'll ever be. She just graduated from Xavier University, and she was working in Denver for a volunteer organization helping the homeless. And I just want to talk about it briefly, because she is such an inspiration to me. Kayla Kim's mom and I were never married. I met her mom when I was going through Mortar Leaders course in Fort Benning, Georgia. And, you know, it never occurred to us to get married. We weren't in love. But we both agreed that, you know, we would be, you know, she was going to bring up Kayla and I would be part of her life. And I was. And by the way, hey, this is a great comment on the different kind of, you know, morality back then, or maybe false morality. As a lieutenant, young lieutenant going in to get Kayla enrolled in DEERS, the adjutant said, hey, you know, your career's over. You know, the battalion commander is going to take a dim view of this. You know, having a child out of wedlock, you're probably going to get relieved, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, my point of view at the time was, well, you know, so be it. It would be far worse for me not to enroll her in this.
Right.
Anyway, he got over it, whatever. And Kayla grew up to be just a wonderful girl. She went to Xavier on my GI Bill. And then was working in Denver, and I had just visited her down in Nicaragua where she was working with disabled kids. You know, she was just that sort of person. So her mom and I, you know, were there in Denver for a week. They thought she was going to get better, but then she slipped into a coma, and you know, we had to make the decision to take her off life support. And I returned to the Siege Sodif. We were going through our final exercise, and here's the weird thing about this, Mac. So there is then a 2.5 month period that is almost a complete blackout for me. I don't remember that final exercise. I'm told that we did well. I'm told that I personally did well. That made sound decisions, et cetera, et cetera. I don't remember any of that. So I don't know what that means. Obviously, I was traumatized. Obviously, something was ingrained into me deep enough that I, you know, I still functioned. But in functioning and putting things and keeping things together, you know, I wasn't solving anything. So, you know, about a month before we deployed, General Votel pulled me aside. Who was then SOCOM commander pulled me aside and said, hey, look, you don't have to do this. No one's going to think worse of you if you don't, you know, if you just pass this to someone else and stay at home. And, you know, I said I was going to do it. That wasn't out of nobility. It was out of fear for what I would do if I didn't go there. You know, I couldn't imagine not deploying at that stage. It gave me a sense of purpose when I really needed a sense of purpose. But here's kind of the denouement of the story. Hard thing to talk about. A month later, when I was out there, I wasn't sleeping. I was going through a pretty bad period. I didn't know, but I thought that my decisions were beginning to become unsound, and I decided to quit. It was like late at night one night, and I just said, hey, in the morning, I will, you know, I let the one-star SOF commander in Baghdad know that I need to go home. I can't do this anymore. For all of us, you know, for you guys listening, that's not an easy thing to admit. That's kind of so embedded in our culture, isn't it? You never quit. But here I was contemplating doing exactly that, resolved to do exactly that. And then something weird happened the next morning. I was shaken awake at 04 by my operations officer, and we had a troops in contact situation. What had happened is ISIS had broken through the what we call the FLOT, the forward line of troops, just up outside Mosul, outside Erbil, and it was a serious attack. They poured about 150 dudes, we think, through the line in multiple V-bids, and they had cut off one of our teams. It was a what we call a trident. It's a SEAL, you know, it was a small SEAL task unit of about 14 guys, and they were almost completely surrounded by ISIS. And so we were, you know, as is the way of modern warfare, we were fighting, you know, kind of managing the battle there in the Jock by using, you know, with ISR and fighting to get fires in support of this team. And I say fighting because that's unfortunately what we had to do. All fires in Iraq were controlled by an Army One Star, and he was reluctant to relinquish those fires to us or to the team on the ground, which is, hopefully all our listeners know, is kind of a violation of rule number one. Is, hey, if you got a unit in extremis, you push everything to them and give them control. But we weren't getting that. And cut a long story short.
And just so everybody knows, if you look for in history a recipe for disasters, and the one that comes to mind immediately is Dakota Myers Medal of Honor. Is a shit show relative to what Andy's talking about. Somebody's got to clear it. They're not there, right? It's centrally controlled. Guys are dying. People are getting the shit shot out of them, and you can't help them because of some bureaucratic thing. So keep going, Andy.
Yeah. So, and I could go on about the control of fires. It was almost criminally centralized. And for the wrong reasons, not for the right reasons. But in any case, in the end, and it was uncanny, you know. I mean, the way ISR is now with FMV, we had a ringside seat of what we were afraid was going to be this team's demise as we watched VBIDs converge on them. And in the end,
tell everybody what FMV is.
Full motion video. Yes, my apologies. So the clarity of the video streaming from ISR drone platforms now is quite extraordinary. And VBIDs are vehicle-borne IEDs. Most of those served in Iraq and Afghanistan, you'd be familiar with those. ISIS was particularly good at constructing these things and making them almost impregnable to direct fire weapons. I mean, and this is the weird thing. They could, in a hurry, converge four or five of these things upon a single target or a breach point. And you think about the command and control at the tactical level that has to take place to have VBID drivers, you know, who are probably not selected for their intelligence just by the nature of their mission, jump in their vehicles and converge on a single geographic point. And that's what was happening on this day. You know, you had four or five VBIDs converging on this team. And what saved their asses was a Peshmerga team armed with Milans, which was the only, you know, direct fire weapon that at the time that could stop them, who was, you know, managing to pick them off. Because you had a one-star JTAC, basically, one-star forward air controller sitting in Erbil, 30 miles from the action, trying to control air. And of course, they weren't having much effect. Anyway, cut a long story short. Team, you know, we managed to link the quick reaction force up with this team. We managed to withdraw them, and the Peshmerga launched a counterattack through ISIS back through the breach. It was one of five counterattacks. I mean, five ISIS offensives that took place while I was there. Later while I was up there, we lost the SEAL. We had several of our guys killed during these. I mean, one guy killed, several injured during these breakthroughs. This time we were fortunate, but I was furious. It seemed to me as though the way that this conventional Army One Star had handled this was criminal. It was not, you know, it wasn't an oversight. It wasn't a mistake. It was criminal, and it violated everything that you and I had been brought up to believe in as combat leaders about, you know, the inherent right of self-defense and giving the guy on the ground the ability to control fires, as you commented. I was so angry, but a couple of things occurred to me that, and this wasn't me being conceited, saying only I could fix it, but I was there in a position that was my responsibility to fix it, and I suddenly realized I can't walk out on this. It doesn't make sense for me to leave and then some other dude to be put in position here, and he's got to learn the ropes and deal with this kind of shit, you know. And ISIS, you know, ironically, ISIS stepped in and saved me from myself and my own worst decisions. Things didn't get much better with that particular Army division and that one star. I was so incensed that I sent a lawyer. I requested an investigation into his actions. The investigation was subsequently shut down. I think I accepted that a little too docilely. I think I should have pushed back and insisted on the investigation continuing. But there you go. You know, I think if you're a half decent commander, you're always kind of second guessing your decisions a little bit and taking a hard look at whether you push back in the wrong place or you didn't push back enough. And that was one area that if I could turn back the clock, I would have absolutely insisted on a full investigation, because he came near to costing lives again later in that campaign.
But absolutely, your point spot on. But to me, the other huge thing is simply by you articulating that, Andy, right? What happens is, and this is my experience, is you're as a leader, right? You're a colonel and you're this guy that, you know, younger Marines look to, and they don't really relate to you. They don't think they can relate to you. When you talk about your shit, all of a sudden they look at you as, whoa, he's no different than me. And you become an approachable leader. And it was really interesting after the first time we did post-traumatic winning at Camp Lejeune, Dave Furness, who we both know, I've deployed, you know, three times with Dave to Iraq and Afghanistan, and then served with him at IOC in the basic school four times. So we're great friends. He calls me and he says, "Hey man, I have to tell you, I cannot go anywhere on this base without people coming up to me to talk to me about post-traumatic winning." And I told him, I said, "You know, only part of that's the class. The other part is what you did. You are now an approachable dude." And he was pretty funny about it. He said, "Look, I go to the gym. Nobody even makes eye contact with me, right?" He said, "And my picture's up everywhere. It's not like they don't know me." And he said, nobody said a word in the, you know, he took command at the beginning of August. This is January. He said, "Nobody's ever said a word to me." He said, "I go get gas. I go to the PX." And I think, though, that's the power of, you know, coming out of the closet and say, "Hey, I'm struggling with it too." And
yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I'm saying? And
I can agree more.
And let me tell you, since we've been sitting here, I've got three emails saying, here's one. Holy shit. I'm sitting here and I can't believe the story he just told. Here's another one. "Mac, good Lord, tell him Semper Fidelis, God bless him. What a difficult road. God bless him. God bless his beautiful daughter. Tell him thank you for sharing." And then in parentheses, "I know you hate that term, but say it anyway." Here's another one.
I'll take it back.
Here's another one from a Vietnam guy. "Oh my God, Andy's story is unbelievable. Please thank him." So thank you. But no, the power when we do that, but the problem is Grandpa went to Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
Or no, Grandpa fought in World War II. You know, he fought in the British Royal Army. Did he ever talk about it? No, they don't talk about shit, right? They drink tea, they smoke cigarettes, and go to the pub. He never talked.
That's a really interesting comment. And in my book, I comment on that because my father was a Second World War veteran. He was on the transatlantic convoys, which is how we met my mom. He was, he was in the British Navy or British Merchant Marine.
Right.
And those transatlantic convoys, as you probably remember, were they were getting torn up by German U-boats. That was after the Battle of Britain. That was the Germans' bid to strangle Britain. But cut a long story short, so he had plenty of issues. God bless him, but you know, nightmares and everything. But we never talked about it. And I remember as a kid listening to him and his friends just talking about the war, and it was all happy, you know, it was all funny stories. That's right. All they told. But they would be slugging gin and tonics. You know, that was their way of dealing with it.
Right. And then, you know, and then Uncle Larry, he fought in Vietnam. He doesn't talk about it. So, you know, we follow in their footsteps. We go to Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm a man. I can handle my shit. I know people that have had, you know, much worse than me. You know, the Lance Corporals that are out there every day slugging it out. Right? I mean, the 0311 who doesn't have ISR overhead. And the way we're going to find out what's down that street is that he's walking down that street. That's what, you know, those guys. And so you say, well, I can handle my shit. And then, you know, it starts to eat away at you. And then, and we all have personal shit in our own lives that is traumatic as well. And but nobody's ever talked about it. And so one of the cool things about this, and you're doing it today, I mean, is, you know, is setting an example to say, hey, look, you've got to do this, because the facing movement to the door that leads to destructive behavior and suicide is isolation. And if you don't isolate yourself, you don't face that door, right? You don't turn that way. You have somebody to talk to, but leaders have to live that. You can't just say it and walk out of the room and think that they're going to do it and they're going to relate to you. But I can tell you this from seeing it over and over again doing this. When you stand up and tell a story like you just told, and you say, hey, man, anybody who needs to talk to me, here's my cell number. I'm here 24/7. Do not be afraid. It's amazing their reaction, because you just gave them all permission, right, to unload their shit on you. And it's amazing the power of that. And I challenge Marines. You have to be the first generation of Marine leaders that look at the people below you and say, it's okay to air your shit. And we need to do that for each other, because we're all dealing with it and we need to stop faking it. It doesn't mean you're disabled. It's part of living life. And so I think it's awesome. And, you know, you teased that yesterday, Andy, when you were talking about, you know, that you just recently, you made a comment about drinking, right?
Yeah. So, yes, absolutely. I mean, we all compensate in various ways. I think for me, yeah, I definitely, you know, went through periods of drinking too much, but it was kind of in a sense, it was a curse, in the sense that I'm not an angry drunk. I'm not a disruptive drunk. I just drink too much. And, you know, I still continue to function when, you know, people would probably hardly notice, or, as you commented earlier, just think I'm the life of the party. You know what I mean? Right. Even goes out and drinks a few beers, right? But I know for me, I was doing too much. And to include, when I got back from Iraq this last time, I came down to Tampa and worked at Special Operations Command Central. But everything that I kind of tamped down post Kayla's death and everything else for years, I think, you know, started to emerge. And it was only then that I actually started to, you know, I went to counseling. I went to see the psychiatrist and the SOCOM guy. And it took a lot for me to make that decision, but it made a big difference. And what it enabled me to do, you never get over the loss of a child, and I don't want to ever get over Kayla's loss. I will think about her every day, but I've tried to use her as an inspiration in my life and to make me a better person. And by doing that, you know, instead of, someone describes me as, instead of feeling as though you are constantly drowning you know, you have just one wave after another breaking over your head, you start to be able to ride it out on top of the water and see over the next breaker and realize that, you know, you can go on, and there's other things to go on for. My other kids, I've got a grown-up daughter who I'm actually visiting tomorrow in your part of the world, there in California, and I've got an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old.
You coming out here?
I am, yeah.
Where?
I'm going to a friend's change of command in Coronado. He's taking over Naval Special Warfare Group 1.
Right.
And my daughter actually lives up in San Clemente.
Well, give me a call and let's go have lunch or something.
I will, yeah. Right. You know, I'm out there for a couple of days, but so I'll give you a call,
okay,
regardless.
All right. No, you know, again, and let me say this. I need your help to get post-traumatic winning into the special operations community. Because I've been told by a whole bunch of special operations guys, hey, we need this. Right? We need this. And you need to go with me and introduce it, because it's that story that every one of those guys is going to look around and go, like, I don't know. I expected this to be like 2.5 hours of my life that I wouldn't get back. I didn't expect that. What's going on here today? Because I'm that guy right there. And so you and I have some work to do, bro.
I would be glad to. Very glad to. And Marine Special Operations community in particular is, of course, very close to my heart. No, that's absolutely. Happy to.
Well, we've chewed up an hour, and we haven't even touched the subject yet.
What do you want to do, man? We can go on and do that now, or I could.
No, you know what I want to do? No, I don't. I'd rather this conversation should stand alone. All right. So I don't know what you're doing tomorrow, but we're going to continue. I'd like to continue Andy Milburn Week here on All Marine Radio, and maybe we can get the damn article that you wrote entitled "When Not to Obey Orders." So we've talked about everything else, but hold on, let me read you an email, Mac. I too am sitting here, and I cannot thank you and your friends enough for doing what you do. I know that shit isn't easy to talk about, but it has helped me in my personal life with things that I've struggled with, and I've never spoken about it. But because of this program, I now have. I am in a better place, but it's not easy for me to talk about those things. You and your friends come on this program on a regular basis and talk about your shit. It is so enabling, and it's such a great example for the rest of us. And we hear how you struggle as regular people, which is also inspirational. What it reinforces to me is the fighters that come out of our culture. And as long as you'll fight, and as long as you'll listen and learn, you can turn your grief into something better. And that's the constant message of this program. And I just wanted to thank Andy for coming on and being a part of it. What a wonderful segment today. God bless Andy. God bless his family. God bless his beautiful daughter. What is her name? So would you say her name again, Andy?
Yes, Kayla. And what a wonderful email. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
No, I mean, you don't have a choice, though, right? You have to honor Kayla. And the more often you tell her story, the more often her story touches somebody's life and changes somebody's life, right, the closer she is to you. So you don't got a choice.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. You know, when something like that happens, it seems so meaningless. It is so meaningless. You have to derive meaning from it. Otherwise, I mean, there is no alternative. Otherwise, you're on a downward spiral.
Right. No, if you can't, you know, have you read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl?
I've read segments of it. I'm very familiar with Frankl, though. Concentration camp survivor. Yeah, extraordinary man.
Moderately interesting place for a psychiatrist to go be interned at a German concentration camp. But no, I mean, it is that, right? It is attaching meaning to your suffering. And again, I would have never told you, you know, after the stuff that happened in my life that started with my parents divorcing and never speaking again, helicopter crash, 4 Marines killed. And as you talked about your daughter, I mean, there's not a week that goes by that I don't think about that. The murder of my two nephews by their father, who then commits suicide after he beats the shit out of my sister, 3 combat deployments, my younger sister freezing to death in 2014 because of her alcohol problem. I would have never believed that I somehow or other would find a means to convert that to something good. and something wonderful and beautiful. But I have, and it is when you use your experience combined with our truths that you're not going to get over it. That if you isolate yourself, you'll destroy your life. That if you drink, if you use alcohol and drugs, you will be alone and you'll destroy your life. If we'll embrace those truths and you combine that with your own experiences and you'll touch the lives of others and transform their lives, you transform your own life. I didn't know that would happen to me. And so to me, that's what I love about doing this. It's as Dave Furness said, you know what? We've done a lot of good shit together. This is the coolest thing we've ever done. Saving people's lives, transforming their lives. And I told all the generals at the General Officer Symposium of the Marine Corps that, you know, the Marine Corps can be an institutional leader in fighting suicide in the country, fighting destructive behavior in the country. If we'll just use the truths that come out of our culture, combine them with our own experience, touch people's lives, we can turn this shit around. And 2nd Marine Division is doing it, no doubt in my mind that it'll happen. And your story is the same story. And that's how I put, there's in post-traumatic winning, there's 3 goals and 9 commandments. They all come from guys like you, Andy, hearing that story over and over. You know, I was a Marine, I did this shit, I came home, I struggled some with it, you know, and everybody's got a different version of that. And then something happened in my personal life. And then I started drinking, and then I got divorced, and then I stayed drunk for 15 years. And then, you know, like the story of Eugene Sledge, you know, Sledgehammer, who wrote, you know, With the Old Breed, you know, his With the Old Breed's 1,000 handwritten pages that he let his wife ultimately type. Wouldn't let her go near it at first. Then he let her type it up because he had these tablets all over the house, his boy said. They were everywhere. And he finally let her in, and that changed his whole life. He stopped drinking, yada, yada, yada. And the book gets published, and then he starts saving people. And a friend of mine who made a video about Kaysan, a documentary called Bravo, he did the same thing. He came home and he said he was drunk for 25 years. And he said, when I mean drunk, I don't mean like, you know, I had 6 beers. I mean, I drink a case of beer a day and then either drink a bottle of wine or a half a fifth of whiskey and do that for 25 years. And what changed his life was a woman who said, I'm not going to hang around for this. And he stopped cold turkey. He then makes the documentary. So he then begins to tell his story. He lets her in, tells his story. So it's those 3 goals and 9 commandments, they're our story. It's the same as my gunny walking up and saying, you know, you're never going to get over this. And so it's guys like you that tell it, Andy, it's the only way to live with it, and that is to use it for the good, to transform other people's lives, which is completely in line with our service-oriented, you know, bent, the way we live, the way Marines live. And so, if you can't tell, I love doing this shit. But it's stories like yours, man, that you know, animate it every day and give it life. And like I said, you and me got work to do, man, which is cool.
Yeah, that was beautifully put, Mac. That you are a you know, I can't imagine anyone having summed that up better. That was
I'm good I'm pretty good at that. I've done it enough, and my passion is coaching, and from what I taught Andy back at IOC, I mean, I love, and then, I mean, could you imagine now, Andy, the emails that I get, you know, imagine, let me just, I'll read you one, and this shit, I get this shit all the time. Right? And I got this one over the weekend. Mac, below is the email. I'm in the 2019 EWS class and was at your brief last spring at Geiger Hall. I've been spreading the word of your message as soon as I got on deck here at Miramar, where I am currently a company commander. My ask is, how do we go about and request your post-traumatic winning brief to be presented to our squadron or even group? There is no doubt in my mind this message needs to get to every Marine on the space. Your candid, entertaining, and truly inspiring brief can really help us get the message to these Marines that, one, not only can we be resilient and continue to operate at a high level despite PTSD, but two, we can help each other. We are the first echelon of care. Let me know how we can get you down here sometime this year, blah, 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 blah. I get those every day. And so I always say, I'm the coolest motherfucker that I know, man, because this happens to me. But, Andy, I want to offer you some hope. You could be cool like me, too, as you do what you do today.
I can.
Right?
How? I could never aspire to be nearly as cool as you, Mac, but I would be privileged to be able to help in any way that I can.
Even if you could be, like, 10 notches down, like, that cool for me, that would still be way fucking cool, man.
That would be winning.
No, but again, as you just talked about, if you don't do that, what are you left with relative to Kayla? The grief? The black hole that is the grief, right?
That's right. You sink into yourself, and because it's so hard to live sometimes with yourself, because we tend to dwell on the things that we've done wrong, that is where, destructive solutions come into play, such as alcohol. I can agree more, Mac.
One of you.
Hey, Mac, I'm watching the dogs about to go berserk.
I'll let you go. Let me read you one more interview. One of your Hall of, this is from another Vietnam guy, one of your Hall of Fame interviews, and every recon guy I knew, I thought was made of granite, but they do have a heart. Thanks again, Andy. So, anyway, there you have it. All right, go take care of your dogs. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Hey, Mac, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, I'll get hold of you this afternoon, let you know what's a good time, because I'm traveling tomorrow.
Let me tell you,
we'll something out.
Well, maybe we can record something later today.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, buddy. Sounds good.
No, hey, first of all, thank you. Saving lives, man. It never ends. So good on you, bud, and I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Mac, and thank you to all of your listeners. It's been a pleasure.
All right. There you have it. Andy Milburn. On the Andy Milburn week of All Marine Radio. Wasn't supposed to go like that, but that's one of the coolest parts of this program is the people that come on and how good they are, and they're part of our Marine culture. And it's just wonderful. So my thanks to Andy for doing that. And we'll get to the article at some point, but let me read another email. I was sitting here listening, and I had read the article in War on the Rocks last night. It's a great article. If your listeners haven't read it, I would suggest read it. If you know anybody that's a leader in the United States military, send it to them. Then you got to talking about post-traumatic winning. And then I sat here and listened to his story. And I sat here and I stopped my work and I just listened with my chin on my hand and my elbow on my desk. What a brave guy for sharing that. And what an inspiration for the rest of us. Let me echo what I've heard others say before. God bless him. He's obviously an exceptional man. From his conduct to enrolling his daughter out of wedlock in Deers, to coming on and talking about Kayla. What a wonderful interview. Get that thing up there quick, Mac, because I want to send it to all my friends. Semper Fidelis.
When I eat.
I will get that up there quick. Didn't see that one coming. I love that stuff, though. All right, that'll do it on a Tuesday of Andy Milburn week. So, if you're just tuning in, we'll check news in hour one. You're about to hear that, and then you'll hear his interview in hour two. And if I was you, I'd grab that link and I'd send it to as many people as I knew and said, hey, check this out. So on a Tuesday, have a great day. Andy Milburn will join us either live or recorded tomorrow, and we'll actually talk about the article. Good dude. Anyway, have a great Tuesday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.